This episode of #AmWriting is sponsored by BookCoaches.com, the number one book coach certification community. A book coach or a writing coach is a professional editor, a mentor, and a cheerleader for writers at any stage of the writing process, from starting from scratch to pitching agents or preparing to self-publish. Book coaches act as a guide and sounding board for a writer over the course of one project, several projects, or an entire writing career, helping them find their way to the end and the next beginning. Our partner, Author Accelerator, provides a free book coach matching service for writers at authoraccelerator.com, but if you'd like to become one of those coaches, head to bookcoaches.com/amwriting to learn more.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone and try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause. I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now one, two, three.
Okay. Hey, I'm KJ Dell'Antonia, and this is #AmWriting, the weekly podcast about writing all the things, short things, long things, fiction, nonfiction, pitches, proposals. In short, this is the podcast about sitting down and getting your work done.
I'm Jess Leahy. I'm the author of The Gift of Failure and the now out, The Addiction Inoculation. I'm just so excited to have it out in the world. And these days you can find my writing at The Washington Post and The New York Times and a lot of other places. But I'm just so excited to be here today. And KJ, who are you? I'm overflowing with excitement. So you see, I almost let KJ go without introduction.
Going to be a great episode. But before we get to it, I am KJ Dell'Antonia, the author of the New York Times bestseller, which I still love saying, The Chicken Sisters, as well as the nonfiction parenting book, How to Be a Happier Parent, former editor and lead writer of the Motherload blog at the New York Times. And right now, entirely focused on novel number two. I wouldn't even call myself a freelancer at the moment, but who knows?
Very exciting. So exciting. So here's what I'm so excited about. So we have two guests today. This is like unprecedented. Our first guest that I would like to introduce is Jordan Shapiro. I found out about Jordan Shapiro, it's been 6 years ago, I think, when Jordan was writing about education for Forbes and a column there that I really loved. And we sort of met through that and end up getting to do some cool stuff together. And I just became a big fan of his writing. And I became a big fan of his approach to topics that normally seem fairly cut and dry. So, for example, with his first book that I fell in love with called The New Childhood, Raising Kids to Thrive in a Connected World, he helped me really think about tech in a different way. And he has a new book coming out on May 11th called Father Figure, How to Be a Feminist Dad. And it's great. I love this book. And Jordan, I also just have to mention, since it's in your bio, that Jordan also, when he was 13 years old, won $10,000 on America's Funniest People by singing a song about what part of the pig hot dogs come from. So there we are. There's Jordan's introduction. Jordan, thank you so much for being on the show today.
I'm excited to be here. And thanks for mentioning America's Funniest People. You know who else was on that episode? The dog Beethoven was the guest host for that episode. So we were petting the dog Beethoven. Remember from the Beethoven movie?
Yes, I absolutely do. The reason Jordan is on the show today is that Jordan is a white male, and Jordan is writing a book about that needed to be a little bit more inclusive than just his white male perspective. And so one of the questions that we get a lot in the #AmWriting Facebook group is about sensitivity readers. And somewhere along the way, when I was talking to Jordan about this book, Father Figure, he mentioned that he worked with a sensitivity reader. And I was like, oh my gosh, can we have this person on the show? And so I would like to pull Jazz in now. And Jordan, would you like to sort of introduce us to Jazz and explain how you two came together?
Oh yeah,
to work
I guess
on
so.
Well,
You know, the book, as you put nicely, like I needed to be aware of the fact of what perspective I was writing from, writing as a white cisgendered male. How do you ask all the questions from perspectives you don't have? How do you make sure you didn't make mistakes? You know, I felt pretty confident in my ability to write about cisgender women questions. I had researched enough about that, but I was really interested. I was really worried, I should say, about whether or not I would make unintentional mistakes that I really didn't want to make when it came to LGBTQ plus issues. And so I looked for a sensitivity reader. And first my editor at Little Brown suggested, I already forgot the name of the site that I found it on, but I reached out to a few different people, happy to talk more about that process, interviewed them, found one that seemed to vibe the best with me. And that was Jazz. So Jazz, I think I'm supposed to introduce you now, Jazz. So welcome, Jazz.
Well, I do want to hear about the process of finding Jazz. You actually mentioned the name of the website earlier. Let's rack our brains.
Quiet House? Quiet House. Yeah, Quiet House. Quiet House is a clearinghouse, or Quiet House is sort of like a matchmaking sort of organization for sensitivity readers and authors?
To my knowledge, it's a publishing company, and the diversity reading was just like an additional project that they had.
Okay, excellent. All right, so could you tell us a little bit about the process of sort of how you came together as a dynamic duo?
Okay, I'll start with that. So what happened was I went on Quiet House. It has a whole list of many, many, many diversity and sensitivity readers, and each one has a profile that tells you a little bit about the kinds of things they read for. I like that you said matchmaking, because it kind of did feel like that a little bit. I was sort of like reading through 50 different profiles, trying to read between the lines and understand like what can I guess about these people and what they're good at based on this based on this little profile. And I think I emailed, I'm going to guess, knowing myself, 4 to 5 or 6 different people. And I think 4 of them responded they'd be happy to talk. And I think I ended up doing phone calls with 3 of them. I remember there was one that I had already settled on Jazz when it was time to schedule. So I didn't do the last phone call. And I talked to the 3 different people and I asked them a lot of questions. I mean, it'll be interesting to hear Jazz talk about this process. Questions I asked just kind of, who are you? What's your specialty? What do you know? But also questions about feminist theory, about queer theory, you know, trying to sort of go, will this person understand really what I'm trying to do with the book? And that was a hard guess. And again, whenever I'm interviewing anyone for that kind of thing, what I'm really looking for is just the sense that I'm going to feel comfortable working with this person. I'm looking for someone who's going to challenge me. I'm looking for someone who's going to ask me hard questions. I'm not looking for someone I'm going to agree with. I'm just looking for someone whose personality seems to mesh, where I'm like, yeah, I could get into some hard situations with this person. And I think Jazz and I talked for about an hour the first time. And then I was like, yep, ready to go. No question about it.
So Jazz, tell us how you got into this.
Interesting. I stumbled upon Quiet House because I actually have family who was published by them. And the main editor was looking to expand the diversity reading team. And so my name came up. And I was looking for some extra projects at the time, and I was thinking, oh, you know, I love to read. I don't have excuses to read anymore, and this is going to be just a perfect way to dive back into a culture that I love so much. So they signed me up, and I just had my name up there, and I waited for individuals or the editor herself to contact me if people were interested.
Have you done a number of projects, or is Jordan among the first?
I've done a few projects, I'd say under 10. Mm-hmm. So it's still relatively new for me, but they've come in all shapes and sizes, fiction, nonfiction, varieties within the subgenres. So it's really been diverse.
And as a reader, how do you see both the need for and the job of a sensitivity reader?
Well, essentially what we are, we're a beta reader who were hired based on lived and personal experience with topics that the author of the manuscript might not have or might not have access to that kind of experience. So, that's my goal with that is really just trying to bridge gaps and create manuscripts that are inclusive and that are proofread by someone who has more of a lived experience than necessarily, like I said, the author of the manuscript.
As a reader, do you find yourself frequently seeing that in the books that you're reading? Like for as a younger reader, did you feel unrepresented in the kinds of books that you were reading, and also probably wrongly represented?
I'd say it's hit or miss. Every project is unique. And so what I found is maybe I'd say fiction was a little bit more difficult with the representation. Nonfiction, I find that the authors did take a little bit more time to research the specific topics that maybe mm-hmm. I would be adding input for. So it varies. It definitely varies.
Talk a little bit about how the process works. Jordan, did Jazz read like the finished manuscript, or was Jazz a part of it as it went along? And did Jazz help shape some of the ideas? Were there things that you found you needed to change from a structural perspective once you had input from Jazz? I'm sort of curious about how the partnership works.
Yeah, I mean, I was pretty close to done, I should say. I was in that, you all know, I was in that like crunch time, deadlines close, and much further away than I'm admitting to anyone, but also knowing that I have to finish it pretty soon. And I think I had the first three parts of Father Figure mostly done. I sent one part at a time to Jazz. I was still fixing up other parts, but it was pretty close to the penultimate draft. But I will say that I think, you know, a lot had already changed in my perspective from working with Jazz, so that in that 1 month of going back and forth with parts 1, 2, and 3, part 4 became something very different than what I had imagined when I had started it. I don't know about very different, but certainly different.
There's a lot of pressure that I was thinking about, the pressure that's on me when I'm coming close to a deadline, and then to add the pressure of, and by the way, you better read fast, Jazz, because we are getting down to the wire here. There's that turnaround time that's scary.
The sort of terrifying possibility that Jazz might have come back and said, this entire chapter is terrible and is going to offend a ton of people.
Yeah,
which luckily didn't happen, but I can tell you I was scared of it.
I really just appreciate the vulnerability, because I think for me, I don't show people my work until it's completely done. And part of that is just because it's so scary to have, especially because you're talking about experiences and life experiences that you couldn't have been exposed to. And so how would you know differently? And yet you don't want to look like you didn't get it in the first place. It's a place of vulnerability that I think a lot of authors would find really scary. What was your experience of that?
Well, I just threw myself into it. I mean, a funny part about it is actually the same time that Jazz was reading it, I was sending it to my own father at the same time. And I used to joke that this was a different kind of sensitivity read because a book that's all about how fatherhood needs to change, going to your own father is a little terrifying. So there were two going on at once. And I guess at that point I needed, you know, I'm like you, Jess, and don't really share with anyone but Amanda before it goes to the editor. No one else sees any writing before it goes to the editor. But at this point, I was at the end, so it was time to do that. And it was, yes, very vulnerable, but also gave me so much confidence afterwards. I mean, it was sort of like I confronted the what I knew was the ultimate hurdle. I mean, the two ultimate hurdles here to me were this, thinking about sensitivity, diversity, and my own father.
Yeah, that would, for me, I think one of the scary things about coming out with a new book that, you know, is there going to be someone with some expertise in something that I couldn't have experienced, and they're going to have just a very different idea about that. And while you can't cover all of your bases, I think you can, you know, sensitivity readers can really help you get there. And so, Jazz, I want to talk a little bit about, it is really difficult to give writers feedback about their work. Let's just put it that way. Like, whenever I ask anyone to read my stuff, or if anyone asks me to read their stuff, I say, now, hold on. What is your goal in giving this to me? Like, do you want feedback about grammar, or do you want big picture stuff? So did you have to have a conversation like that? Like, what kind of feedback do I want? What kind of feedback, how do I want to give it to me? That kind of thing. How does that go?
Yeah, so for me personally, I have kind of a rubric or a document, a report document that I set up. But again, this varies author to author. So when we spoke for the first time, I kind of got a taste for what kind of input Jordan was looking for. And so in reading the manuscript, I am someone who just, I love everything. I was excited to read it. I was excited by the topic. And so immediately I have to tell myself, okay, Jazz, be objective. So as much as I read a sentence, I'm like, oh, this is so beautiful. I have to remember to go back then and say, okay, but from the perspective of someone with my lived experience, what can be changed? And so personally, I have a difficult time because I don't want to necessarily critique a work that I find excellent, but that is my job. And so, I mean, the giving input, I try and make sure that it's within the topics that are specifically requested by the author. If there's any additional comments, I'll usually add them at the end, but I really try and stay within the realm of topics that have been discussed prior to reading. And like I said, I try and remain extremely objective with those points, despite necessarily falling in love with a piece. I have to remember that, this is what my job is. Right. I have to remember that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You are, in a way, another editor. And so if we come to that relationship with sort of the, this isn't personal, this is, and these are not assaults against me as a, a person, then we can handle it. But we writers, we can be a sensitive bunch. And it's hard because, a book really is like birthing something and you feel so personal about it and you feel so, sensitive about the language that you use that I could see that would be tricky. So I guess the takeaway there is as long as you're dealing with this as like a business relationship and this is my job and this is my assignment and you come to terms on sort of, we've talked about this in terms of co-writing books as well too. One of our co-hosts, she co-writes a lot and it's just something I've never had to deal with as a writer, but I really can appreciate that, how that working relationship would work. So from your perspective, Jordan, looking at your book before Jazz read it and the book that you would have created if Jazz had not been a part of this process, how were those books different? Was there a difference? Do you feel like there's a difference between the work that you would have created on your own and the work that you have created with Jazz on board?
I think it's better. I'm not sure the goals ever changed. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think what Jazz really enabled me to do was to meet my goals in a much more comprehensive way. And so in that sense, it's not so much that the book would have been different, but it certainly wouldn't have been successful. And the truth is, I mean, maybe it would still be successful, who knows, but it wouldn't have been successful from my perspective of doing what it needed to do. And I don't know, I feel like Jazz, you should give some examples of some of the things.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. I would love that.
Sure. I mean, like, first off, I know we spoke about it briefly, Jordan, how you sent it to me in different parts, and each part of the book had a different theme that you discussed in the introduction, like the four guiding principles that you're trying to present for fatherhood with this book. And so it was fun for me going through piece by piece and seeing how I could apply my notes in a way that would represent the message you're trying to create with this book. And so I looked out specifically, an example would be my lived experience as someone who's non-binary and using language that is appropriate for someone who is a non-binary parent, for example, or a parent who is parenting a non-binary child, things like that.
Jordan, did you hire Jazz as an independent contractor or was this something you did through your publisher? How did the nuts and bolts end of it work?
I hired Jazz as an independent contractor, and I think that's always different, whether or not publishers are doing it or not. But I hired Jazz directly myself. I mean, with a lot of conversation with the publisher. Certainly, it was not a private secret thing. And I wonder if. I don't know if the publisher ever saw Jazz's report. I'm wondering if I ever if I ever sent that. I don't. It didn't really matter because I had addressed pretty much everything. Well, mm-hmm. actually everything in Jazz's report was I ended up addressing. So the reason I'm saying that is because I could imagine if I had not addressed some things, I would have also sent my editor the report so they could have a judgment on whether it was okay for me to ignore this piece of advice.
And the other thing, so I and KJ have no problem talking about money, but I know it can be really, really sensitive. So I'm going to ease into it by asking if this was a sort of an hourly rate or a project rate. How did that work? For someone who wants to hire a sensitivity reader, they're going to be looking at like a project rate or that kind of thing.
I mean, I'm going to guess it depends on the reader. I got very different quotes from different people.
Okay.
I mean, they were all similar. The cost didn't play any role in my decision-making process. So they were close enough that it wasn't like, it wasn't that kind of question. But it was both a project and a per word.
Oh, okay. Oh, that makes sense. I am just find this whole entire thing fascinating. And one of the things that's been really interesting is as authors are writing about experiences outside of their own. I know, like, for example, Serena, our co-host who's not with us today, she writes about people who are very different from her. And she also brings on board sensitivity readers to help her understand what their perspective might be. And I think in telling stories that are a part of experiences that are outside of us, there's going to be this need to say, oh, hold on, wait a second, let me help you understand how this experience might be perceived differently. And I'm so grateful that, Jazz, you're doing the work that you're doing so that we can have books that are for everyone and not just for, you know, a white cis male experience or a female, you know, white female cis experience.
So,
because we're all learning. Yes, KJ.
Without specifically talking about any of the fiction projects that you've done, because who would, you know, I mean, that would be silly, but I would love to hear what some of the experience of being a sensitivity reader has been with fiction. What are some of the kinds of things that you find yourself talking to authors about changing or evolving?
In fiction, it often comes down to issues of description of race, gender, or class. Mm-hmm. That's often what I found myself dealing with. Sometimes it deals with mental health subjects as well, which are sometimes a little bit more difficult to describe if you don't have the lived experience.
But would that be like the mental health experience of living life as LGBTQ+? Is that what you mean? Or are you talking about sort of a specific, you know?
More general. Okay. Let's say someone who experiences depression, anxiety, or, you know, a variety of other mental health topics. Addiction also mm-hmm. is another one that some authors discuss. And I'm happy to give feedback on those kinds of topics. And
I was actually Serena's sensitivity reader on her addiction stuff for one of her books. I read through some stuff and it was really fun because she basically said, does this feel authentic to you? Does this feel like something that someone would be experiencing? And in that way, when I have that sort of those instructions, it was really fun to read it for that angle. I hadn't ever really done that.
Yeah.
And that's exactly the question that I ask myself when I'm going through the manuscript is, does this feel authentic? If this was coming from, you know, my own lived experience, is this realistic? And that's how I base my notes that I provide to the author.
And if it's not, do you ever find yourself in a position of saying, what if you did this or what if you did that? Have you ever done that with authors?
Yeah. So sometimes if it's something simple, I might just point out a specific part of the manuscript. I might put it in quotations or I might point to the page that it was on and say, hey, I would suggest maybe replacing some of the language here, and I might not give a suggestion because it might, you know, be obvious enough. Whereas in other situations, I might see a need for a specific item of vocabulary, and in which case I will give an example of what might be a more appropriate way to phrase the phrase in question.
Have you had experiences where an author is portraying a fictional response or emotion that you didn't feel like was authentic to the way someone would really perceive a situation?
I believe so. Yes, I'm trying to pull a specific example. Coming up, it's been a little while, but I'd say definitely.
It's. I was thinking about the difference between nonfiction sensitivity reading and fiction sensitivity reading, and you know, I'm possessive of my stuff, but that's not, but my stuff is coming from like the world out there, whereas like with fiction, this is so elaborate up in here in your head that to have someone else come in and say, no, that thing that you're perceiving up here in your imagination isn't going to ring true for a reader who has actually experienced that. It's a really interesting sort of blending of the real and the completely fictional world. I love that. It's a really cool place to be.
Well, I would imagine that you find yourself in the position of, it's not really a question of, would you have felt that way? It's a question of, does that ring true to you as a member of this community that the author is not a member of? So that's a really, that's yeah. a different approach.
And I could see that there would be times when you'd have to hire more than one sensitivity reader for a project. You know, if you had, you know, anyway, we've been talking about them. I can imagine that you could be like, okay, I need like three or four people to help with this particular intersection of characters in my world. And that could get interesting. That could get really, really interesting. I would love to have like do a book club. And it would, this would be so nerve-wracking and horrible, but have all of everyone in the room together discussing your manuscript. And all of the things. Oh my gosh,
that'd be a great like podcast episode. Just we'll get people to just dissect your
yeah,
next
dissect
work.
Dissect my work. Yeah, that would be really fun and so help good for my mental health right there. Yeah,
Jazz, do you like doing this?
Honestly, I love doing this. I have a preference for nonfiction, which is another reason why I loved working on this specific project so much. Nonfiction specifically. I get to touch on subjects that I like to discuss in my daily life. Whereas with nonfiction, it's maybe a little bit more difficult because I do sign normally a non-disclosure agreement where I don't talk about the specific contents of the manuscript. And so obviously fiction that I end up, I'm completely alone. Whereas with nonfiction, it's sometimes more general or yeah, more general topics that you know are part of my daily life. And it's exciting to talk about them and then to apply my experience and even my discussion with my peers and my colleagues and other people in my immediate environment, how to apply that to what I'm reading in this nonfiction piece that the author has obviously done research on and is, you know, hoping to get the best version of what message they're trying to put. They're trying to get that best version of it out into the world. So I do find that specifically exciting.
It's also really exciting that we're at a place right now where we're talking so much more about how representation matters and it's important to see yourself in books and it's important for that kid to read something and say, oh, that experience feels so real to me. And I love the fact that suddenly now, you know, now more than ever, we're thinking about how to ensure that we're inclusive in our writing and that we represent real lived experiences and allow. I always think of that kid who, you know, for the first time ever says, oh, wow, that's me. That's me in that experience. That's how I always, at its essence, that's what it means to me to be inclusive of shared experiences. So,
well,
thank
and also one thing, I think you as a nonfiction writer and writing something that's going to be pretty widely talked about in the media and show up in bookstores. And one of the things that I was really nervous about was how do we normalize certain things, right? And are we normalizing inclusive things or non-inclusive things? You know, every book an author like any of us write and end up sort of setting a standard for what people consider just normal. And that was why it was so important to me, is that I didn't want to write a book about fatherhood that put normal binary, I shouldn't say normal, see, it's not even normal.
Jazz got out their red pen for that and put a big circle around Jordan's screen on the computer.
Right. But didn't want to have binary or heteronormative assumptions built in, which doesn't mean I was trying to write a book that was about, like, you know, I wasn't trying to write a book that was about all the different parts of a gender conversation or a sexuality conversation, but I definitely didn't want one that was about fatherhood to be alienating or marginalizing anyone from being allowed to participate in that conversation or feeling that they were normal in that conversation. And so that's why jazz played such an important part in this book.
Jordan, were there specific parts of the book that jazz commented on that were harder to understand what you needed to change, or that were more of a surprise to you?
I mean, the big surprise for me was actually how that there wasn't a lot more. I mean, I had to change, and that was because things would come from jazz that made me go, whoa, I hadn't even considered that. How did I not screw that up 16 other times? Like, as soon as I read it, it made sense. I mean, jazz is very, very, very good at what they do, and it was all clear to me, but there were places there were so many places where I tried to use inclusive language, and I did it by saying things like, I don't know, let's say boyfriend, girlfriend, or non-binary friend, and jazz pointed out that you can't even put a third category there as if it's a category, right, because that starts to imply another that it is something when it's actually not something. It's the right to not have to be categorized, and so there were places like that where that hadn't occurred to me in that way. Like, I thought I was doing the right thing. And so much about this book is about this, right? Fathers who believe they're doing the right thing, who want to do the right thing, and just have not considered it. So those were those places where things would just pop up, and then I'd go back and go, how did I get this wrong? And how did I not get it wrong every third paragraph, considering I had never considered it before? I would think I was very lucky in many ways. But I don't know, there was nothing that was that hard. I could imagine that if I were maybe if I were writing a different book that wasn't so much about being inclusive and hadn't just spent a year and a half of my life thinking about how do you have a much more responsive, inclusive way of interacting with people, that I might have been defensive or struggled with some of the things. But almost everything was sort of a simple fix. I mean, that's the thing about all this stuff, is like, it's not hard. It's not, it's hard to know all the things and to recognize all the things, but it's really not a big deal for us to say, hey, we'll use different pronouns. Like it doesn't hurt me. it doesn't hurt me to use inclusive language. So why wouldn't I?
And personally, I love that moment you described where, like, oh my gosh, I had never thought about it that way before. There's that sort of moment of sort of wonder, and then a little bit of embarrassment that I've never thought about it that way before. But the overriding emotion for me is, cool, I never thought about it that way before. So I love that. And I really am enjoying the relationship between the two of you on this book. It sounds like it was a fulfilling, I hope it was a fulfilling relationship for both.
Yeah, I was gonna say too, it was, like I said, it's hard to be objective if you're reading something you really love, right? And so I just, I have to sing Jordan's praises a little bit. I did really enjoy reading this book. And in giving my feedback for the example that he just provided, I actually used the example that he wrote in the book and tried to apply something that was actually included in one of the sections about, putting people into categories. And I was like, so you talked about putting people into categories. So now let's talk about, and it was honestly, it was a really fun experience for me to, I was applying something that I was learning through his own book that I was reading for him. So I feel like we really, it was a good match for this book. If I do say so myself, I had a great time.
I have to say, Jazz, it sounds like you're an awfully good teacher too, because that's a real talent, is helping someone see something using, especially when you're using someone's own examples. That's a really, that sounds like you'd be a really great teacher. You are a really great teacher.
Thank you. I do have a background in education, so I appreciate it.
Lovely, lovely. KJ, do we need to take a break for a sponsor message?
Always.
Hey, listeners, would you like to know when a fresh episode of Hashtag AmWriting is ready? Hear all the details when we accidentally don't drop an episode on time, or get KJ's random top thoughts while recording an episode as memorialized in the show notes? Subscribe to our weekly podcast email at amwritingpodcast.com, and all of that can be yours. Plus, if you decide to support the pod, you'll get writer top fives and bonus episodes, as well as access to all the earlier bonuses on things like recording audiobooks, finding an agent, starting a revision, and book launches. Find out more at amwritingpodcast.com.
So this has been a fabulous conversation about how the two of you worked together. And now we would like to shift gears a little bit and talk about the other things that you have been, what have you been taking in as readers? This is the part of the show where we like to talk about what you have been reading. Well, then I'm going to start with Jazz. What is something that you have read and really enjoyed lately besides the excellent father figure by Jordan Shapiro?
Besides the obvious. So one book that I love to talk about, I pull it out of my bookshelf every once in a while just for some refreshers. It's a book called Beyond He and She, What's Your Pronoun? It's got great references for inclusive language. It's by Denis Baron, Dennis Baron, I believe is the English pronunciation. And it's a wonderful book about expanding your understanding of pronouns outside of the binary and the historical uses as well, which I find very interesting.
I may have pronouns are crazy fascinating. First of all, I have a very small amount of experience in trying to learn to speak Chinese for a mm-hmm. trip that we took a long time ago, and they don't use pronouns. So, and I have an adoptive child who had some experience with Chinese language as well as with English language. And when she first came to this country, pronouns to her were interchangeable. So that was a really interesting thing to watch. And it made me very aware when later in my experience as a parent, I began to have friends with non-binary kids and to want to use the more inclusive language. It made me very aware of how when your language has the pronouns, it just invades every part of your thinking. So even if you're now looking at, you know, a non-binary child who you have never related to, in a gendered way. Like, I mean, it's a child, right? You've never had a case. It's not like you've had to think of them in some way that had to do with biological, you know, some biological function gender, yeah. that requires. So, but there you are, your brain still wants to do it. It's really, really difficult. Whereas if we lived somewhere, you know, if our language didn't include so much pronoun, it would be
we don't even have gendered nouns.
Yes. I have had to try to have this conversation with my Spanish teacher to ask, like, how do you all deal with the gendered nouns? And it's almost like there's a language barrier because I'm not that great at Spanish, so I don't know the answer yet.
You speak about this from French, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, this is my whole life. Linguistics and grammatical gender consumes my all day, every day. I'm from a French speaking community. French was actually my first language, and French is a heavily gendered language. And so even just learning to understand inclusive, non-gendered language in English was an adjustment, because if French is like Spanish, where all the nouns are gendered, grammatical gender is, you know, everything that's associated to the noun takes on the gender of the noun. And so that was a really big adjustment, even just trying to understand, English has a gender neutral, French doesn't. Oh my goodness, how do I believe in French? I'm studying Danish actually right now, because Danish is very similar to English as what we call a natural language, where they have the pronouns and they have some gender, but they're also very, very loose and inclusive with the language. And then if you go further up the ladder, so there's gendered languages like Spanish and French, natural languages like English and Danish that have, you know, the pronouns, but not necessarily gender. And then there's genderless languages like you just mentioned in Chinese, and also
Finnish. I should have said Mandarin, because
Mandarin, absolutely.
I actually don't know about Cantonese, but I believe it to be the same.
I believe so as well, based on my research. Turkish also is another language that some English speakers like to learn as a genderless language, because it gives them some insight into exactly like you were saying, you know, growing up without that in your language, it impacts how you communicate in general with, you know, kids.
So what is the approach in French where every descriptive, and this is what I was trying to ask my Spanish teacher, like every descriptive noun, if you're saying writer, you have to apply a gender to that to get it to be correct. What is the approach in French to taking gender out of the language or making it a little more neutral?
So
or a
French,
lot more neutral.
French is a little bit different than some of the other Romance languages where you have, you know, Italian and Spanish, where a lot of the endings of words are just or and it's, you know, the gendered ending. In French, we have like full long 5-letter endings where you can't really interchange masculine or feminine, and there isn't really a neutral available. And so right now I know that in France particularly, they're refusing to use inclusive language. Usually what we do is we put a big round dot in between where it would be the masculine ending or the feminine ending. But even then, you're putting masculine first, for example. So that's still not super inclusive. And it's still using both masculine and feminine. So it's not really creating anything that's gender neutral. So this is definitely a work in progress in French right now. We're slowly introducing it. There's the pronoun IEL, spelled IEL, which is kind of a mix of IL and EL, which is he and she. And so we're trying to push a little bit for inclusive endings to kind of be changed from what they are now to be that neutral. So combining the feminine and masculine to create a neutral, but we're a long way away.
But that's the cool thing about language, is it is a living thing. It is evolving. It's changing. That's the definition of a living language, is that it will continue to evolve and change as we do. And I love it. I love it. I love it. Jordan, what have you been reading that you like?
The best thing I've read recently is Interior Chinatown by Charles Yu. Is that his name?
Yes, I talked about it on a previous episode. It's excellent.
Oh, it was fantastic. I mean, I actually finished it and immediately decided I was gonna use it this semester at Temple University for my students. I always try to give them something brand new, but that was really great. That was definitely the best thing I read all year. And right now I'm reading the new novel by Ishiguro, the Clara and the Sun, which I can't wait to hand to my children because I know they're gonna like that too.
On my list. I was actually just talking to my favorite bookseller yesterday, but we were talking on the street, not in the bookstore, so I haven't bought mine yet. I just finished Conjure Women, and we're going to have to look up the author, but it's a book set in the time in and immediately after slavery that focuses very much on the experience of the enslaved and the transition that they underwent, and it's really fascinating. That's all I got there. It's just a really interesting read, and it's also a little bit interesting just as a thought exercise, because the author is a Black British person, not a Black American, but writing about the American Civil War, and especially with the things that are going on. We're recording this a little earlier for listeners, with the things that are going on with Harry and Meghan and the British media right now. It's kind of interesting. I'm also reading Talia Hibbert's most recent book, which is completely different. It's called Act Your Age, Eve Brown. Yeah, but still, thinking about the differences between the Black experience in America versus England is particularly interesting at the moment.
And my book I just started Act Your Age, Eve Brown was going to be, and I'm listening to that on Libro FM, and so far really enjoying it. It's funny, the things I listen to are directly related to the projects I'm working on. And right now I'm, you know, signing book plates and doing that kind of stuff. And I'm also painting a bookcase, and this book is carrying me through that. And I'm really, really enjoying it. So, oh my goodness, thanks to both of you so much. This has been such a fascinating conversation. I have been dying to ask that question about gendered languages like French and Spanish for ages, especially since I was listening to David Sedaris and talking about how hard it was for him when he was learning French to remember the gender of things. And someone told him that for native speakers of French, it's just nothing they think about. Like, it's just this thing is feminine, this thing is masculine, and it's a fixed It's a fixed attribute of that thing. And so how you separate that out is a fascinating conversation that maybe we'll have to have again another time or something like that, because it's so cool. All right, until next week, everyone, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game. The Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perilla. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Save. Pause. Stop.
Thank you.